Okay.
We had left off last time, we were going, jumping a little bit through the Kuzari, but one of the points which the Bala Kuzari made, Rav Yehuda Halevi made, was a total rejection of any need to answer the proofs of Aristotle. And we pointed out that this was really like a slap in the face, so to speak, to whatever had been accepted in medieval philosophy at that time. Most of the medieval Jewish philosophers, again starting with Rav Sadia Gaon, going through the Rambam and Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra and the like, you know, they all felt the need to somehow respond to Greek philosophy as presented in particular by Aristotle. That, you know, whatever Judaism had to say, it had to respond to some of the claims that Aristotle made. It took them seriously. It took the person of Aristotle seriously, and there needed to be some kind of dialogue, so to speak, between Torah and the point of view of Greek philosophy. Rav Yehuda Halevi comes along with one stroke of the pen and says, nah, we really don't have to do any of that. Aristotle, yeah, he was a smart man, but after all, he was just a philosopher. And had he had Masorah, if he would have had a tradition from Sinai, like we the Jews had, then he wouldn't have come to all those silly conclusions about the fact that the world is eternal and things of that nature. So in one fell swoop, he does away with, you know, an individual and a philosophy that was virtually deified, you know, for all intents and purposes, by both the non-Jewish world and the Jewish world at that time in the Middle Ages. We might have thought, you know, the truth is, you know, in reading it last time, we might have thought that Rav Yehuda Halevi is maybe being a little extreme in the way in which he dismisses Aristotle. I mean, after all, the Rambam obviously took Aristotle seriously enough to write a good part of Mor Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, trying to deal with some of the issues that he raised. But, you know, in a sense, sometimes when you have, you know, when the pendulum swings too much to one side, it's important to have a very extreme view on the other side to bring things back to a balance in the center. I mean, they say in a similar fashion that the early Hasidim expressed their gratitude to the Vilna Gaon for having come out in opposition to Hasidus. Why? Because Hasidus, like any movement that starts, you know, there's always a certain tendency towards extremes that happens in the beginning, and certainly there were elements in the early days of Hasidus that were, that did not fit into the, did not recognize, let's say, the centrality of Torah study and the like, you know, to the Hasidic enterprise, and having the Vilna Gaon's opposition, you know, was a necessary counterweight to kind of even out the score and have the Hasidic movement end up, you know, in the middle, you know, adopting the, you know, the wonderful emphasis on spirituality that the Baal Shem brought into the world, and at the same time not abandoning the focus on Limud HaTorah. I mean, some of the greatest Gedolim afterwards were Hasidic Rebbes, you know, some of the biggest poskim, the Divrei Chaim, you know, the Avnei Nezer, you know, there were greats in the world of Hasidus who were, you know, great Lamdonim. And, you know, again, a lot of the early Hasidim attributed that eventually to the fact that, you know, the Groh had come out, the Vilna Gaon had come out swinging when, you know, Hasidus started. So by providing the counterbalance, you know, he made sure that the movement didn't move off too much in a bad direction. So in a similar kind of sense, you know, even if we feel that Rav Yehuda Halevi might have, you know, been overly dismissive of Greek philosophy and Aristotle, after all, I mean, the rest of the Rishonim thought it was something to be reckoned with, it was important to have that that cold water, so to speak, to realize that, you know, Greek philosophy is not the be-all and end-all of everything. And indeed, you know, you come around in 2009, and the ideas of Greek philosophy, the eternity of matter, and things of that nature that Aristotle held of, you know, and held of with tremendous conviction, now nobody really believes in those things anymore. So all of the things that the Rambam felt that he had to address, you know, the average person today isn't particularly bothered. When they have doubts about religion, it's not that, oh, the universe must be eternal, and, you know, therefore I'm doubting the veracity of religion. You know, people have doubts that are of a different nature nowadays, but the kinds of fights and issues that the Rishonim had felt that they had to deal with when dealing with Aristotle and his philosophy, just, you know, not so much on the table anymore. So that was Rav Yehuda Halevi, who was very dismissive of Aristotle. And I want to just pick up with paragraph Samech Ches 68. where the Kuzari says as follows. So Amar HaKuzari, Samaches, 68. Amar HaKuzari, Daili Be'ela HaTainos HaMaspikos B'Sharazeh, Imterach Chevrosi Imecho Atricha Cholaharus LiHaTainos HaMaspikos. Okay. You know, you've convinced me about, you know, how Aristotle's proofs, you know, about the eternity of matter and the eternity of the universe are really not that convincing, not that compelling. And at some later point in our friendship, we'll take it up again. Aval shuv el gugul dvarecha, veheach ischazik benafshechem adover hagadol hazeh, shiel abori hagufos varuchos vanafashos vascholav amalochim, asher nis'alo viskadish viskado measoges haskholim kol sheken meachushim, Chibur im habriya hazos hanivza hamaguna v'chomra. But there's still one thing that's bothering me, says the king of the Khazars. How can it be that God, who is so exalted and so beyond anything in this world, how could he possibly lower himself to connect in any which way with the creation we see around us? And even if you tell me that nature is incredible, the smallest of insects, of creatures, has tremendous wisdom within it that no person can truly understand. So God's creation is just so incredible, which shows you how God himself is so incredible and so above anything that we can possibly relate to. So how can it be that God would choose to, or would even deign to communicate or to interact with human beings? Now, if you recall, this goes back to a point which the Kuzari made in the very beginning of the Sefer, when he introduced when he had the philosopher come and speak to the king of the Khazars, and present his ideas about philosophy. The philosopher, again, who's presenting Aristotle's view of the universe, says, we believe in a God, but precisely because we believe God is so exalted and so beyond everything, we think it impossible for God to really have any meaningful interaction with the world. We don't believe that God is aware of the things that we do, because after all, the same way you and I aren't really aware of what's going on in the world of ants, in any meaningful fashion. So God's knowledge is limited to things which are great and eternal and transcendent. God doesn't really care, frankly, about anything that we do, right? Because after all, do you care what the ants do? So if you don't care what the ants do, why should God care what you do? And God doesn't really get involved in our world. It's beneath him. I'm sure if I had an ant colony, there are plenty of fights that the ants get into one with another. I'm sure they have their own stories of political intrigue and the like. Whatever. I don't really waste my time with that. So the same way I don't waste my time with that. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't waste his time with us. He certainly wouldn't bother to communicate things with us. That's ridiculous. Why would God bother to communicate things with us? I'm not going to issue commandments to the ant world. So in a similar fashion, why would the Ribbono Shel Olam want to issue any commandments to our world? Right? So this is a basic pillar of Aristotle's philosophy. And says the king of the Khazars to the Jewish rabbi, you may have convinced me that Aristotle's positions on the eternity of the world don't make sense, but I'm still having trouble with the basis of Judaism, which is that God cares about people, is involved with people, and communicates things to people through revelation. I'm having a much easier time with, the notion of the transcendent God, the God who's far above anything having to do with the world, which is the notion of Greek philosophy. Right? So there's a little bit of a back and forth. But to kind of pick up where the Rav responds to that question, I want to turn to Ayin Zayin, to 77. where the Chaver, the Rav, talks about God's clear involvement, you know, the clear wisdom that went into the workings of the world. And he says the various aspects of creation, the sun, the moon, and the light, the sun, the moon, and the stars, carry out the will of God, even though they don't consciously know how that works. Right? I mean, the sun rises and sets because God put it into its nature to do so. But clearly the sun doesn't make a conscious decision to rise in the morning and to set at night. That's part of the program that God has instilled in nature for it to work in a certain way. Similarly, he writes towards the end of that paragraph, Kasher yarchik me ho'ish ve'ho'isho yitziras havlod bihischabram, ach heim omzrim lachomer hamikabil tzuras ha'adam, he uses the example of a man and woman coming together to form a child as an example of God's constant involvement in the world through the process which we know as nature. Right? So a man and woman come together and they create a child. Now, the man and woman don't know how that, you know, they don't, they may understand the biology of how it works, but you can't say that they're directing that process in a totally, you know, that they have total control over the way that process works. They know that when they come together in a certain fashion, you know, nature has it in such a way so that, you know, the result of their coming together is the production of a child. But in a sense, it's really the Ribono Shel Olam instilling certain powers in the world that come out when people follow certain procedures, right? You know, I don't, you know, the man and woman don't make the procedure work. They're so to speak, they're instruments for, you know, for the latent powers which are placed in them by the Ribono Shel Olam to come to fruition, right? So too, says the Rav, there are so many latent powers which the Ribono Shel Olam has implanted in creation, which we can't even fathom. Right? In other words, you know, the same way, I mean, okay, you can explain the biology of how it works, but, you know, you would, unless you knew, unless you saw it in action, I mean, you would never think that, you know, a man and woman coming together in a certain way should be able to create another human being. I mean, we're still, I mean, the truth is, you know, almost 2,000 years later, you know, we're perhaps at the cusp. You hear every once in a while about, you know, we're close to being able to, you know, produce certain things genetically. You know, maybe in another 100 years, they'll be able to produce clones and things of that nature. You hear stuff around, you know, you hear stuff of that nature every once in a while. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But you know what? It's been, you know, 1,500 years since the writing of the Kuzari. And, you know, this secret of how life comes to be is still very much a secret. It's still very much a mystery. We can, you know, perhaps trace the biology of it, but we can't reproduce it in the laboratory. We can't produce life on our own. There are certain latent secrets which the Ribono Shel Olam implanted into nature, which the people in nature and the objects in nature can serve as, you know, a conduit, so to speak, to bring it out, but we don't really understand how it works. Right?
Cloning is the same thing.
I'm sorry?
Cloning will be the same thing. We know that if we do this and this and this,
right,
something,
right,
but why and how, we don't know.
Right, right, but here,
and we won't know.
But right, but Kolzman, even, you know, until we even get to a stage where we're cloning, we're even on a lower level. We don't even know how to reproduce this. We know that if you do such and such an activity, it works, right? But we're certainly not directing the process. We can't, you know, we're not masters over the process to be able to do it on our own. We have to do it in the way in which, you know, we know that it works based on the laws of biology. Yeah. Right.
Not, you know, it's understandable. somebody creates something or makes something that they care about the product that they produce. So it's very different to say,
Yeah, the human being has no interest in the ant. Exactly. I have no interest in the ant because I didn't make it. But if I had created the world in its entirety, it's hard to imagine that I wouldn't have an interest in the goings-on. And the very presence, just to follow up on that point, the very presence in nature of these secrets, these mysteries which... we as human beings still can't produce. The mystery of life, the mystery that two people come together, a man and a woman, and all of a sudden a new human being is created out of that in a way in which no human being can fathom. That very mystery itself gives you a sense that God is involved with and has cares about the workings of the world itself, because otherwise, just have it go on a kind of autopilot. The very fact that human beings are distinct from one another, each one with his or her distinct personality, and there's so many mysteries that go into the composition of the human being, seems to speak to the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam does have an interest, so to speak, in the details of how the world plays out. Says the Kuzari, and says the Chaver rather, so building on that idea, based on that example of the mystery of life, where there seems to be just this divine process at work that brings children into the world. Okay, we understand there's a biological process, but we don't really have a handle on how it works. That's not the only such example of where you have Rishamim in Yonim Elokiyim, divine traces in this Olam HaTachto, in this lower material world. When human beings are simply ready to accept and work with these traces of divinity that are in this world, when we're ready to accept them, we'll find that they're all around us. V'zehu shoresh ha'emuna v'shoresh ha'meri. The notion that there are divine traces and divine powers that are hidden in the world around us that we can't even fathom, this is the source at the same time of emuna and of meri, of both faith and rebellion against God. So that's a very interesting statement. The Rav says this to the King of the Kesars. You should know this concept that there are divine imprints in the world around us, which we're not even aware of, is simultaneously the source of faith, at the same time that it's the source of rebellion. Amar Akuzari, ve'eich yiyeh sharish ha'emuna hu sharish ha'meri. I don't get what you're saying. What do you mean? That the one thing can be both the source of faith and the source of rebellion. So let me explain it to you. Omar Achover, King, it's true, let me explain. Ki hadvarim asher yikonu lekabel harishamim ha'em ha'elokiyim, einom biyecholes adam, v'lo yuchlu l'shar kamusam ve'echusam. Those things, that those imprints which are on the world, which are divine imprints, are things which are there, which we human beings don't really understand, and we are not capable of manipulating. Again, just go back to the example we had before. We know that if a man and a woman get together in a certain way, a child is produced. But we don't have the ability to manipulate that. With the best of intentions, they can't get together and say, okay, I want a blonde. It doesn't work, I'll put in an order for a redhead. Or, I'd like a boy this time, or I'd like a girl this time, maybe this one with curly hair. Right. I'm sorry? No, the truth is that is something which actually scientifically they are pretty close to, being able to determine the gender. Right? Okay, but it's 2009. I mean, it's been a long time since we've been working on this for a while, and again, when we'll see it when we see it, and we'll get there, but I think eventually they will get there. But again, there's so many things which can't be determined. When it comes to the process of childbirth, we know vaguely how it happens. We know what we have to do to produce it, but we don't really have control or the ability to manipulate the process. So too when it comes to so many mitzvahs. That's going to be the idea that he's going to develop. Sometimes human beings have the erroneous understanding that mitzvahs are basically man-made things and that we can control them at will. You know, I mean, for certain people, Shabbos works. For other people, Shabbos doesn't necessarily work, right? For certain people, maybe the karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash were nice to be brought this way, but maybe I would prefer to bring the karbanos another way. In other words, you know, there's a certain attitude of the religion that says the details of the, you know, religious activities are basically arbitrary, and we can manipulate them. You know, in other words, we can manipulate them to our tastes. You know, if we think that Shabbos doesn't work for us exactly the way it is now, you know, so okay, so we'll choose to do it a little bit differently. He says no, that it doesn't work for exactly this reason. Achavayasam v'chiburam v'zimun lahem, for the mitzvahs to work properly, tzarich bozel yediyah shleima mefureshes tachlis haber me'eso elokim. The only one who really understands how mitzvahs do what they're supposed to do is God. Right? And therefore, he's the one who told us exactly how to carry out these mitzvahs in a way in which they are spiritually effective. And if you deviate even in the slightest from what the Torah demands, you know, in terms of the details of the performance of the mitzvah, it's simply not going to work. Right? I mean, again, not to belabor the point, but, you know, if a man and woman decide that, you know, they're going to have a child together, they're just gonna, you know, switch positions in a way in which it's, you know, totally doesn't make any sense. And, you know, why should the position matter anyway? Okay, so clearly we understand it's not going to work. Or if, you know, it's at a time of the month where, you know, it's not possible for her to get pregnant. You know, but they say, no, but we'd rather do it at this particular time. Okay, that's very nice that you'd rather do it at this particular time. But, you know, the biology is the biology. You have to work within the confines of the way the Ribbono Shel Olam set up the world. So the same is true with mitzvahs, right? You know, there's certain things, l'mashal, right? Again, I'm speaking to women, but, you know, with men, you know, the halacha is that the tefillin is supposed to be centered, you know, exactly in the middle of the forehead. And, you know, again, because it's one of these things that's difficult to control, it's very easy for the tefillin to slip away from one side to the other. So a cynic might say, okay, so the tefillin are not exactly in place. I mean, who cares? You know, the main thing is I put on the tefillin, right? So no, I mean, you know, it's sort of like any other process. You know, there's certain details to the process that are essential. If the, you know, the husband and wife get together when she's, you know, it's impossible for her to get pregnant, so she's not going to get pregnant. So in a similar kind of fashion, if the tefillin is just slightly askew, you know, it doesn't, whatever it does in terms of, you know, creating a spiritual connection between us and the Ribbono Shel Olam, it's just not going to do that. These are not arbitrary rituals which human beings invented. Remember, again, go back to the beginning of the Sefer, the philosopher basically said, however you want to reach out to God is fine. Make up your own religion, make up your own rituals, you know, whatever does it for you is good. Right? A very modern attitude, right? The Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is responding to that. He's saying, no, the same way there's certain biological processes that only work when they're done in a certain fashion, and the latent divine spark has to be unlocked in this way and no other way, so too the mitzvahs contain a latent divine spark. They're not just arbitrary rituals, but they only can, the spark inside can only be unlocked when you do it the right way. And only God knows exactly what that right way is. Umi shehigio hadover azev kimo saw gvulav utnov belev shalim hu ma'amin. The definition of a ma'amin, of a believing person, is somebody who believes that the way God set up the performance of this mitzvah is the only way in which the mitzvah will accomplish spiritually what it's supposed to accomplish. If a guy conversely tries to come to God by using his own logic alone, and as he says to himself, I mean, come on, what does it really matter that tefillin are here, the tefillin are there, the mezuzah is this place on the door, the mezuzah is that place on the door. Come on, it doesn't really matter. The main thing is that when I come into the house, I should have a reminder of God's presence. So you know what? Instead of putting a mezuzah, I'll write God, you know, all over the doors of my house. I'll spray paint G-O-D, you know, wherever I go, right? So, yeah, I mean, if you're looking at things from a human perspective, it accomplishes the same thing, right? I mean, the mezuzah reminds me of God. The word God spray painted on my door reminds me of God. So why not, right? So yeah, but that's only true if you're looking at things in terms of what meaning it has to me. The mitzvos are not subjective. The mitzvos contain the ability to unlock certain spiritual connectives to, you know, between us and the Ribbono Shel Olam, and they only work when you do them in the right way. So he says, V'hoya, I'm skipping down a little bit, I'll give you the following mashal, says Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. V'hoya kaksil asher nichnas ba'otzar rofe. We can compare the person who tries on his own to make up various rituals and ways of coming close to God to a fool who walks into a doctor's pharmacy. Meforsam ki refuosof mo'ilos. And this doctor, it's known that, you know, his prescriptions and his medicines are tremendously effective. Right? So you're not a doctor. You know, you're an NMD, no medical degree. Right? So you wander into the pharmacy. Veharofe enenu bo. And the pharmacist, the doctor, happens to be out. So you figure, okay, no problem. You know, I could figure this out. You know, the red bottle, the blue bottle. You know, it's you know, I'll put everything together. Uvnei adam hayu mechavnim el haotzar hahu levakish toelis. A lot of patients have gathered to the pharmacy. They're looking for medicines. So you figure again. You know, the fool figures, oh, there's no big deal. I mean, what does a doctor do? He just, you know, you hand him a slip of paper. He gives you one of these medicines. Oh, I can distribute medicines also. The fool just distributes the medicines haphazardly. He doesn't really know the various medicines. And he doesn't know the quantities. I mean, again, anyone who takes any kinds of pills. So, you know, again, it's a foolish attitude, which hopefully your pharmacist or your doctor, you know, talks you out of early on in the process, that, well, you know, if one pill works, two pills should work even better. And 10 pills should really work. Right? And so he writes, you know, the fool who goes into the pharmacy thinks that, you know, he doesn't understand the concept of amounts. He doesn't know which medicine to give to whom. He doesn't understand the concept of amounts. V'hemis anoshim rabim. And exactly that, you know, so the fool who wanders into the pharmacy kills so many people, Rahman al-Itzlan, kills off so many of the patients. I mean, it's one way to reduce your workload, but, you know, I don't think it's the optimum way. He kills so many patients by, you know, distributing these medicines haphazardly. And ironically, he kills off the patients by giving them the very medicines that they would have needed, because they would have worked in the right quantity. But now that he messed up the quantities, either too little or too little of a good thing or too much of a good thing, is also potentially harmful. V'im yizdame, shiyakabil toeles echot mehem bakelim and akelim ahem. Let's say, you know, the fool happens to hit the jackpot, you know, by happenstance. He happens to give somebody a medicine that actually works. Yatu b'nei adam olav v'yomru kihu amo'il ad asher yiru l'zoloso to'elas b'mikra. Right, so everyone will clamor to receive that particular medicine, not realizing that, you know, they happen to stumble upon it by fluke, and what works for that one person isn't going to necessarily work for everybody. Yatu gam came a love, v'lo yedu shi'amo be'atzmuso omnam hu atzus harofe ahu achocham asher chiber harofuo sahem v'hayu misharo sam karoi. People don't realize that ultimately it's not this medicine or that medicine which is the panacea. It's the wise doctor who stands behind the medicines and the prescriptions and decides what's appropriate for each individual person. And there's a whole series of practices which the doctor prescribes besides the medicines. The medicines, it's very interesting that he writes, it's very contemporary. The medicines only work as part of an overall regimen. You have to have a diet, you have to have exercise, you have to have, you have to have proper rest and waking up at the right time, and avir, you know, you have to be exposed to the right kind of climate and things of that nature. Right? So in other words, you know, there's a broad plan which a good doctor gives to his patients. There's no quick fix which, you know, people say is going to work. It has to be part of an overall plan. Now, this philosophy of mitzvos and the mashal which Rabbi Yehuda Halevi brings of the fool and the pharmacist speaks very much, I think, to two aspects of the contemporary scene, you know, where people make a mistake. You know, the first group, which obviously he's addressing, are people who think that the mitzvos are basically subjective, and we evaluate their usefulness or lack thereof in terms of what they mean to me. Right? And, you know, clearly Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would have a very hard time, as would anyone. But, you know, this argument in particular speaks to the reforms of the reform movement, you know, made 250 years ago. Because the whole basis of the reform movement was exactly this ta'os, you know, this mistake, which Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is addressing. The reform movement basically posited that mitzvahs are only meaningful to the extent to which they're meaningful to you. Right? So, you know, the early reform movement rejected most of what they called the ritual activities altogether. You know, the kashrus fell by the wayside. Shabbos fell by the wayside. The early reformers attacked bris milah as being a barbaric act. You know, anything which was ritualistic, they threw on the side because they felt that didn't talk to them whatsoever. The current reform movement, you know, the past 10, 30 years, has swung back to tradition tremendously, right? There's a renewal of interest in things like kashrus and Shabbos and mikveh and you know, all of what we consider to be the mitzvahs ben adam la'makom. But unfortunately, it's everything on their own terms. So, you know, instead of a woman going to mikveh as part of the process of taharas ha'mishpacha, that when she experiences, you know, she experiences being a nida, so we see the mikveh as being a tahara process, so the mikveh becomes a kind of fuzzy way of achieving renewal in a general sense. You know, so if a woman's feeling, you know, really depressed and she wants to get out of her funk, you know, she'll go to mikveh, you know, just as a way of making herself feel better. So that would be a classic example, so, you know, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, of, you know, the fool in the pharmacy. You're taking something which is a medicine. In other words, the Ribbono Shel Olam prescribed this medicine called mikveh, you know, as doing something spiritually for a woman who's undergone a specific set of circumstances, and you're prescribing it for a totally different set of circumstances. You know, I mean, you know, it's like the inexperienced school nurse, you know, nobody's a school nurse here, right? You know, right? It's like, yeah. The inexperienced school nurse, right? You know, okay, so let me be very... The inexperienced school nurse, you know, present company totally excluded, who, you know, when you go to see her during the lunch break and you see, and you say, you know, my stomach is feeling a little bit queasy, you know, she takes out a Band-Aid and hands it to you and says, okay, maybe you should try this, you know, your stomach hopefully should feel better after this, right? You know, there's certain medicines and certain things that work for certain kinds of ailments, and you know they're totally misapplied when you apply them to different ailments. So the same thing over here. Mikveh is a tremendous tool that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us. You know that again, we don't understand exactly how it works, but it brings a level of tahara to a woman who's undergone certain life experiences, certain biological experiences, and to kind of throw it around as a feel good activity for somebody who's just feeling down on themselves. If you're feeling down on yourselves, go and talk it out with somebody. The mikveh is just not an appropriate solution, you know, to that sort of thing, right? The same thing is true, you know, of all of the misuse of all kinds of brachas, you know, which again has permeated even into certain parts of the firm community. Shehechiyonu is a beautiful bracha, you know, to be recited upon, you know, important events and new activities that a person undergoes. But there are halachas that govern when you're supposed to say Shehechiyonu. To say Shehechiyonu just because I'm in a good mood, you know, which, you know, again, I've seen people advocate that sort of thing, you know, is a misuse of the medicine. It's the fool going around in the pharmacy, right? So that's one area where clearly the words of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that the mitzvahs are to be seen as different medicines, and they don't just work subjectively or haphazardly, right? They, you know, they work in very specific, you know, formulaic fashions. You know, clearly, you know, that would be a very strong point that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would make to the Reform movement and, you know, all people who buy into that way of looking at the world. I think there's another area where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's words are very significant, and this is something which we find oftentimes in our own machana, in our own camp, and that's people who go gaga over segulos of various types. Right? Now, segulos have their place. I mean, a lot of the skulos are associated with, you know, very venerable Talmidei Chachamim and Rebbes and the like. But the whole point of a skula, you know, the whole point of a, I'm trying to think of a good word for translate skula, you know, an activity which is supposed to bring about blessing in its wake. You know, like reading a certain chapter of Tehillim on a certain day, or doing a certain activity at a certain time. The whole effectivity of skulos is to awaken the person to think about closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu at a particular time. Right? So for instance, you know, the Gemara already says that on the eve of Rosh Hashanah we're supposed to have certain symbolic foods. In a sense, one might call that one of the earliest skulos we have. I mean, let's be honest. You know, what do you think is a better way of making sure that you have a new year? Doing tshuva? Or eating the head of a fish, right? It's very clear that doing tshuva is the main thing over here. But the idea behind eating the head of a fish is that symbolically this is going to trigger something in me to want to do tshuva, to want to have a good year. And mimela, the skula is effective to the extent to which it has an impact on me to want to go and do the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Right, but to see the skula as a kind of magic panacea without taking into account the holistic picture of which Rabbi Yehuda Halevi speaks is to miss the point. Right? I always find it very bizarre and tragically amusing when, you know, people are incredibly makpid on, you know, skulos, and then they'll sit and talk the entire davening from beginning to end without stop. Right? So what do you think is more important? Do you think it's better to say Shemone Esrei with Kavana? Or, you know, I read once in a Sefer that if I say this particular passage on a Tuesday of a particular week, three times, you know, Chumash with Targum Unkulos, so that's going to be a skula for Parnasa. The biggest skula for Parnasa is to daven Shemone Esrei properly, and when you say Baruch Aleinu Hashem Elokeinu Hashanah Azos, you should turn to God and ask Him for Parnasa. Right, the best skula for success in life is to be honest in all of your business dealings. But that's way too hard, you know. So if I just take a red string and I tie it around my wrist, you know, so that's a lot easier than having to be honest with people. So, you know, the skula becomes a replacement for the holistic picture of devotion to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to His Torah and His mitzvahs. It's kind of like what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi describes in the end of his mashal. The fool goes into the pharmacy and he happens to stumble across one medicine that actually works, and all of a sudden this becomes the medicine that everybody has to have, right? You know, this medicine cured this guy of his high cholesterol problems, so let's give it to the other guy who has heart issues. Well, you know, because it cured him of his cholesterol problems doesn't mean that it's going to work for this guy with his heart issues. All right, no, never mind. It worked for the other guy. If it worked for the other guy, it should work for you. Right? That's not the way it works in medicine. We understand that. And we also understand that there are no get-rich-quick schemes. You know, it only works, yeah, I mean, yeah, it helps him lower his cholesterol, but the fact that he exercised, you know, every day, and that he ate healthy, probably had something to do with it also. Nah, just, you know, give him the anti-cholesterol medicine. That's what this emphasis on skulos, unfortunately, is like. You know, skulos have their role because they can trigger the person to a greater appreciation of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from us. But if you don't have this overall picture of trying to fulfill the mitzvahs, you know, so the skulos are not going to work particularly. The same is true for chumras, to be honest, you know, for personal stringencies. So personal stringencies are wonderful. There's nothing wrong with them. But the first thing you have to do before you're stringent is to follow the basic halachas. Well, oftentimes people are very strict with the chumras, but they don't follow what the halacha itself is, right? There's an old joke that if God had only, you know, instead of writing thou shalt not steal as one of the Ten Commandments, had he just put a little footnote in one of the super commentaries to Shulchan Aruch, some have the custom not to steal, so then, you know, many more people would be careful about not stealing. Nebuch, it's only in the Ten Commandments, you know, so this way it's not as widely observed. Had it been presented as an obscure custom or a stringency or something of that nature, so then many more people would have gravitated towards that. Again, there's nothing wrong with stringencies per se, but a person always has to make sure, you know, that before he's going to adopt personal stringencies, that he or she has to be careful about, you know, the laws themselves. It has to be part of a, you know, holistic picture. So all of that, which again speaks in so many different ways to many of the different mistakes, you know, that are part of the Jewish community today, both I think within the Frumma Welt as well as, you know, outside of the Frumma Welt. So that these are all things which are implicit in this mushel of, you know, the fool going into the pharmacy and just, you know, dispensing medicines, you know, whatever way they like. This was the way people were in the world prior to Moshe Rabbeinu, because, you know, what's the medical book which teaches us how to dispense all of these medicines properly? It's the Torah, right? I mean, so before the Torah is given to the world by Moshe Rabbeinu, it's anyone's guess how to properly distribute and dispense all of these medicines. You know, we have to, in other words, prior to Moshe Rabbeinu, people had to guess the best way to achieve a connection with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Now that we have the Torah, Baruch Hashem, we don't have to guess anymore. God laid out for us exactly which medicines to take to create this relationship with God. But prior to Moshe Rabbeinu and the giving of the Torah, that didn't exist. Zulasi ma'at mizahar niftim b'nimusei hakochavim b'atvoim v'netokim min nimus el nimus me'alokai l'alokai. With the exception of a select few, people were pulled in by astrology and idol worship. In other words, people were yearning to establish a connection with God. You know, it's a very interesting way of looking at, you know, the idolatry on a certain level shows a yearning, a desire to connect to God, to connect to the spiritual forces in the universe. But because the Torah hadn't been given yet, people just didn't know what medicine to take. They took all of these, you know, mistaken medicines, you know, thinking that, you know, a belief in astrology or returning to idols or all kinds of amulets and things of that nature, they thought that that would bring them closer to this spiritual force which they could sense in the universe. And therefore people would go from one religion to the next, from one god to the next. Ve'efshar shemachzikim b'rabim mehem. Some people held even multiple religions because they figured, let's hedge our bets. You know, whichever one is going to work, we'll stick with that. They would forget their ultimate leader and creator, who is God. Right? You have to realize that ultimately the best medicine is that which God implanted in the world, which works in a certain way. And when you remove that element from things, that is when you do things which, you know, don't have that seal of approval by the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's when the person is going to get into trouble. Let's bring this back to the very beginning of the remarks of the King of the Kesers. The King of the Kesers wanted to know from the Rav, how is it, how do we know that, you know, why don't you believe in the idea of philosophy that God has no interest in the carryings on and the doings and the workings of human beings? How do we know that God really cares? And essentially the answer that the Chavir gives is we see both in creation as well as in religion these divine imprints where certain things that you do in nature or in religion just work, and they create something divine. So the very presence of those traces must mean that God has an interest in us. Otherwise, why would He leave these, you know, little like treasure hunt pieces, you know, throughout creation, which enable us to have this connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? In other words, we can feel when we perform certain mitzvahs, we can feel that that gives us a connection to God, and it's something about the way in which we do the mitzvah that enables us to have that feeling. That's obviously implanted in the mitzvah itself. Why would that be implanted in the mitzvah if not for the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam has a vested interest and, you know, desires us to, you know, to come close to Him, to have, you know, to have this relationship with Him? That's why He implanted these things, you know, in the in the various mitzvahs which we do. Okay. I think it's a little bit early, but you know, the next topic is a little bit at length, you know, so I think maybe we'll leave it for next time. The next topic which the Kuzari goes into is the way he understands the origin of Judaism. He goes through a lot of the early history of Judaism, and again he discusses a concept which we've had before, but he comes back to more at length. The ultimate proof of Judaism as opposed to the other religions is the very public way in which the miracles of Judaism were revealed to masses all at once, and specifically that the revelation of Har Sinai took place in front of so many different people all at the same time. There's no denying such a public revelation, in contrast with the revelations claimed by other religions. God spoke to this one, God spoke to that one, God spoke to three people, you know, but there's no claim of a massive public revelation like we have in Judaism. That in its own right speaks to the truth of the history of Judaism and God's relationship with human beings and His revelation of the Torah to Klal Yisrael. Another concept which we're going to get into next week is the very unique perspective that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi takes on the whole story of the Egel HaZahav, you know, the golden calf. And we'll see that his interpretation of that story is very unique, and he works that in to his whole account of the early history of the Jewish people. So that, Be'ezus Hashem, we'll see when we come back next week. And hopefully we'll have the books. I ordered 20 of them. I still don't have an exact price for them, but I guess we'll find out when we get them. It's supposed to be substantially reduced, and we'll have hopefully the Sfarim available for purchase during the course of this next week, and certainly by Monday, you know, we'll have them available.